From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a father tries to comprehend his son's unfathomable acts of evil. We talk with Lionel Dahmer. His son Jeffrey Dahmer killed 17 males and practiced necrophilia and cannibalism. Lionel Dahmer has written a new memoir in which he examines every possibility he can think of that might explain why his son turned out the way he did. That's coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Assistant Attorney General Webster Hubbell has resigned. He served as the key liaison between the White House and the Justice Department. He's leaving amid questions about his billing practices while he was at the Rose Law Firm. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Attorney General Janet Reno announced today that Hubbell informed the president of his resignation this morning. Reno said he decided that he couldn't do two things at once and was stepping down to, quote, resolve old private disputes. An internal audit of the Rose Law Firm began as early as the summer of 1992. The pace of that inquiry sped up considerably this past month as the firm was subpoenaed as part of a criminal investigation by special counsel Robert Fisk. Hubbell, who worked at the firm with Hillary Clinton, allegedly overbilled clients and has been linked to Whitewater, the failed Arkansas land deal. Reno said today that based on his character, she doesn't believe he did anything wrong, and that will ultimately be made clear to everyone. She said Hubbell's resignation will be effective as soon as possible. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
The Pentagon says a U.S. warplane assigned to American forces in Somalia has crash-landed in Kenya. One crewman is reported dead and 10 others are missing. 3 crewmen survived. There's no indication the plane went down because of hostile fire. The plane was en route to Somalia to conduct a routine mission. The names of the crew members have not been released. Oregon Senator Bob Packwood has dropped his fight to keep his diaries away from the Senate Ethics Committee. The ethics panel is investigating charges of sexual misconduct against the Oregon Republican. Tess Vigland of Oregon Public Broadcasting has more.
Packwood's decision marks a stunning reversal in tone for the man who less than 2 weeks ago vowed a fight to the end with the Ethics Committee. 2 days after U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist rejected Packwood's emergency request to keep his diaries from the committee, the senator pleaded with an audience of Oregon Republicans to join his battle against the allegations and the ethics investigation. But he has now dropped his appeal of a U.S. District Court ruling that ordered him to surrender the diaries. In a news release, Packwood says although he is disappointed in and disagrees with the court's decision, he will abide by it. But he went on to say it frightens him to think that the private thoughts, hopes, dreams, and despairs of all citizens can be seized by the government. Neither Packwood nor his office had any further comment on today's decision. For National Public Radio, I'm Tess Vigland in Portland.
Turkish authorities report at least 15 people have died in the collision of an oil tanker and a freighter on the Black Sea. A gigantic fire and several explosions were triggered. The ships collided at the Bosphorus Strait, that's the passage between the Black and Mediterranean seas. The important shipping lane has been closed. Turkish officials say the burning tanker is being towed away from the shipping lane. On Wall Street, the Dow is down a point at 3861. This is NPR. 8 former workers of American Honda Motor Company are pleading guilty to charges of bribery and fraud today. Federal prosecutors in New Hampshire say 5 other former Honda employees are under indictment. The 13 allegedly paid or received bribes and gifts to receive dealerships or vehicles that customers would pay more for. Authorities say American Honda as a company is not under suspicion. It's the U.S. distributor for Honda and luxury Acura automobiles. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has concluded his meeting with Russian Minister Andrei Kozarev. Christopher made the visit after a 4-day trip to China. The BBC's Paul Anderson reports.
At the end of his China trip, Mr. Christopher is reported to have said that he and Mr. Kozarev may put up solutions for some of the world's crises. The most logical area for any joint diplomatic initiative would be Bosnia-Herzegovina. The success of the United States-backed Muslim-Croat Federation Agreement depends now on the participation of the Bosnian Serbs. There, Russia has proved it's got greater sway than anyone else. It's already succeeded in getting the Serbs to pull back from Sarajevo. A joint initiative on the Middle East is also possible. Both sides are trying to jumpstart the peace process, which has been blocked since the Hebron massacre of Arabs last month. But there, Russia has less clout. Its influence over the Arabs has diminished, and Israel has rejected a proposal made by Mr. Kozarev during a recent Middle East trip for a new peace conference.
Paul Anderson reporting. Florida officials have released a report claiming illegal immigrants cost the state $884 million last year. Governor Lawton Childs says the federal government ought to pick up the tab. He wants to sue the federal government to make up the cost to state public services for the estimated 345,000 illegal aliens in Florida last year. Childs also says the Immigration and Naturalization Service selectively enforces the law. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lionel Dahmer, says he is tortured by the deeds of his offspring. His son is Jeffrey Dahmer, who is now serving a succession of life sentences for murdering 17 males. Jeffrey Dahmer had sex with some of the corpses, dismembered some of his victims, and cannibalized some of their remains. Lionel Dahmer says the horrible acts he heard described at his son's trial seemed like the acts of someone Lionel could not possibly know, much less someone he had brought into the world. Lionel Dahmer has written a new memoir in which he examines his life as a father and tries to understand what went wrong with his son and how a son's dark side could remain so hidden from a father. The book is called A Father's Story. Lionel Dahmer is a research chemist. He and his first wife, Joyce, divorced when Jeffrey was 18. Lionel says Joyce had serious mental problems that sometimes incapacitated her. Jeffrey committed his first murder shortly after the divorce. But Lionel says he knew nothing about his son's crimes until the police uncovered them. And when he found out, it was a complete shock.
I sat there just like this at my desk, facing you, staring at my wall with my periodic chart. Chemical periodic chart, and just sat there like that for a long time, not being able to comprehend what was going on. And I did not think that it could be anything like, you know, him murdering someone, because he was kind to all animals. He never killed an animal. He loved animals. He loved his dog Frisky, and you know, it just never occurred to me that he could even hurt an animal, let alone a human.
But yet, you learn later, I mean, everyone learned later that he tortured animals when he was young. Or that he, I mean, hadn't he, like, decapitated animals and put their heads on sticks or something?
Yeah, that's true. He had never tortured any animals. But he had collected road kills. I've questioned him intensively, mm-hmm. you know, since then, and he has nothing to hide now. I think that 95% of the time he's telling the truth now. But he did, as I learned it for the first time at the trial, that was what was so puzzling, that I had not been aware. There was not one word said to me. I did not know about his roaming around on his bike looking for roadkill in the Bath Road area of Akron, Ohio. And I did not know that he had found a dog and then, you know, put the head on a stake. And later some neighbor boy had been wandering in that woods area and taken a picture of it.
So much of what you did know about your son, I think, was reinterpreted once you found out
right
what he had done, and you started looking back at your past and wondering, well, what did this mean? Was this just, for instance, you write, when he pointed to his belly button and asked what would happen if someone cut it out, was this an ordinary question of a child who had begun to explore his own body, or was it a sign of something morbid already growing in his mind? What are some other examples, or what's one other example of something that happened when Jeff was young that you looked back on and said, well, maybe this was a sign of early derangement, or maybe it was normal, I don't know.
Well, really, there were no I've gone over, you know, I've agonized over this, mm-hmm. and I've, to save my sanity, I've also gone to a wonderful clinical psychologist, Robert Kirkhart, and he has since deceased, and Robert Silverberg has taken over, and I have to emphasize, this is one of the things I want to tell people, don't think that there's any shame in seeking therapy. It was absolutely necessary in my case. And we examined all of these possible clues or signs or red flags. And quite honestly, the one that you mentioned, question that Jeff posed to me, you know, what happened if we cut out the belly button? He was approximately 3 to 4 years old. I had a bunch of tape recordings, the old style reel tapes, and just miles of those. And I had those transcribed onto cassettes. And in going over those, I ran across this one statement where we were just conversing on the tape, and he asked that question. And at the time, it was obvious that I didn't think anything of it. It was just a quick question. We were talking about the human body a little bit, and we passed it by. In retrospect, everything is, you know, sort of, everything that I look back on now is sort of, it's in a new light. I mean, I wonder whether there was anything brewing in his mind, but as far as overt signs that really a person could pick up, there really weren't any.
You're just joining us. My guest is Lionel Dahmer, and he's written a memoir about his life as a father and his relationship to his son, trying to understand what could possibly explain the atrocities that his son committed. And the memoir is called A Father's Story. You write that you think Jeffrey's darker side attached itself to his sexuality. And I'm wondering if you saw a change in him when he started to undergo puberty, if his personality changed, if there were other changes that you could see.
I didn't really see any other changes except a deepening shyness, sort of. And I had deep feelings of shyness when I was young, and inferiority feelings, which usually goes along with shyness. And that's what I saw, a reluctance. You know, he became more timid, became seemingly less able to initiate conversations and talked a little bit quieter and just, you know, sort of withdrew. Now, it really wasn't until the divorce began in earnest around the first part of 1977, when he was about 17, that the expressions on his face looked more anxious, sad, even more withdrawn, just a very dark appearance.
You write in your book that you made, quote, small, ineffectual offerings towards steering your son toward a normal life. What did you think was abnormal about his life?
The only thing that I really felt was abnormal was his extreme shyness and feelings of inferiority and non-participation socially.
So he had no friends or very few friends?
He had a few friends, and there were enough, I think, to make me believe that it was not all that bad. He was not living in... We never lived in the city where there were a lot of friends and acquaintances nearby like I had when I grew up. And so there were a few friends, and just enough for me to believe that, you know, there was nothing really abnormal about that.
Now, you keep referring to how inward he was.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that is perhaps one of the reasons why you had no clues to his inner life, to his fantasy life. Though, you know, I really wonder how often kids really let their parents in on that anyways.
I've talked to a lot of parents in writing this book, and they, almost to a person, tell me that their teenagers just did not want to let them in on some of their private thoughts, and there was no way that they were going to find out. But I still think that a loving and a wise and a persistent parent probably eventually can pull out some of the thoughts. And if I just agonize over, I just really feel badly that I, you know, maybe could have done more of that and been alerted to some of these things. Like if I had known that he was collecting roadkill from, you know, one of his peers, or maybe the parent of one of the peers might have said, hey, Jeff is doing something kind of weird, or did you know he's doing this? And then it might come around to me.
One of the things you actually knew that he was doing, and this was when he was in his late teens, I guess, you found out that he was really drinking heavily. And I think you learned this from college students when he was briefly in college.
Yeah, that's right. Well, actually, before he went to college, my wife, Sherry, came home one day from work on her way to an appointment and found him dead drunk in his room. And that was the first time, that was when he was 18. That was the first time that I realized he had a quote, severe alcohol problem. You know, I always felt that maybe he had a beer or two with his friends in high school, but he never came home, never was inebriated, never was slurred, there was never any slurred speech, there was never any signs like that. There were never any signs like that until that one day that Sherry found him dead drunk. And then this happened time after time.
Okay, so this is something where you felt like you could really go into some kind of
action
as the father.
You're
and try
right.
to discipline him or punish him or talk him out of it. So when this came up and you saw it and you felt like you should take control of the situation, what did you try
to
do?
We took him to a therapist immediately and also enrolled him in AA. I mean, he didn't want to. I guess there's probably very few people who really want treatment until it gets so bad they just, you know, beg for it. But he did not want to be treated. So he would go in the front door, and when I would leave for work after dropping him off at a therapist's, he would go out the back door. He would leave. And he did attend AA for several sessions and actually got a buddy as they, you know, go through that program. But that dropped off real quickly, too.
No, I believe by the time he was, you were hoping that he'd go to therapy for his drinking, he'd already killed somebody, unbeknownst to you. And you were thinking that all your attention, all your hopes to try to get him off alcohol was trivial compared to what was really going on in his life and in his mind.
Knowing what I know now, I can just imagine him thinking, God, why is my dad trying to get my alcoholism treated or talk about these mundane things when I did what I did to that first person? I can't imagine how trivial it must have seemed.
My guest is Lionel Dahmer. He's written a new memoir called A Father's Story, in which he looks for clues that might explain how his son Jeffrey became a serial killer. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lionel Dahmer, and he's written a memoir about being the father of Jeffrey Dahmer, and the book is called A Father's Story. There's a period, this was after his brief stay in college, when your son lived with your mother, with his grandmother. And she found all kinds of troubling things that she would call you and your wife about. For instance, Jeffrey had a department store male mannequin that he kept in his closet fully clothed, which was a very odd thing to find. She found a gun under his bed, and then she started smelling horrible odors. Now, how did you interpret this when she'd call you up and tell you about it?
Well, she was more puzzled. My mother was more puzzled than upset at first when she found the mannequin. She couldn't figure out what on earth that was there for. And so she told Sherry about it, and Sherry thought that there was something very strange about that. And I said that I would call Jeff immediately, which I did. And he gave me the story that it was just something he wanted to try to do, get the dummy or the mannequin out of the store. It had some clothing on it, and it was a challenge. And he said, you know, in his usual fashion, he said, Dad, this is just about how he would say it. Dad, yeah, it was a dumb thing to do. I know it was. But I threw it in the trash up in the big dumpster up at the end of the alley, and it's done with now. You don't have to worry about it anymore. I won't bother Grandma anymore.
He killed two people in your mother's house, and she smelled terrible odors. What was his explanation for that?
Well, on a couple of occasions, my wife would call, or my mother would call my wife, Sherry, and talk about the bad odors. And the first time that happened, I again called Jeff and talked to him about it. And he said that he had a lot of time on his hands, and he was just experimenting. And I guess I related right away. In that very basement, I had a lab set up.
When you were young, because you're a chemist.
Yeah, and I made, you know, chlorine odors, terrible odors down there. And so immediately I thought, well, you know, it seems reasonable when he says he's just mixing bleach and peroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and cleanser and so forth. He was just, you know, cleaning up some mess and just fooling around with the mixtures just to, you know.
But there's a difference between chemical odors and putrescent odors.
Yeah, that's right. He explained the bad odors in that sense as some of the cat odors.
The first time your son did time, it was for a sexual offense, for sexually molesting the 13-year-old boy.
Yes, he was arrested prior to that, as we had learned, for public exhibition and put on probation and sent to a psychologist.
Well, did that help you? I mean, did you still had no idea what was really happening?
Well, when when we found out that he had been arrested for public display, mm-hmm. you know, drunkenness and publicly displaying himself and put on probation, he was, as part of that probation, he was mandated to go to a therapist for his alcoholism and for, you know, other things. And when I made a paid visit to that therapist in Milwaukee and found out that this therapist was not trained in alcoholism, not at all. And furthermore, she just allowed Jeff to continue coming and paying and getting nowhere. This is the story. This is a common thread all the way through. There just seems to be no effective follow-up or examination. These programs just keep going on and on. If they would only just spend a little bit of money and do it right. But I guess this is a common complaint throughout the nation.
When your son was found guilty of sexually harassing mm-hmm. a 13-year-old boy, you said that you knew at that point that redemption could only come through a higher power, through the state or through religion, that you weren't going to be able to save him as the father.
Yeah.
Now, the state, I mean, they try rehabilitation or prison or something. Religion, now you are a religious man.
I'm a Christian, yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel that religion could save him? Did you have hope for that?
That statement that you just referred to, I felt, you know, that something outside me could only something outside of me could be effective. The reason I thought that way and still do is that I had tried so many things. I tried mopping up after so many of his activities, trying to talk to him, trying to straighten him out in so many different ways that I just finally admitted that it's not within me to do it, apparently.
Have you found any comfort in your faith? Has your religion been challenged or deepened?
It's been deepened. But one lesson that I've learned is that when with things involving people, the environment, such a complex interaction of parameters, I have to watch myself. I have to say, look, let's just put it in the hands of God. I mean, we'll do everything we can, but let go. And this is what I recently talked with Jeff just the other day.
But here's here's what I'm wondering. I mean, like your son's actions have been perceived as many people as being like the devil. I mean, he had certain kind of cult-like practices, and even you know, like mutilated limbs were, I believe, arranged in kind of tableaus. And it's so just against the faith. If you feel like you put yourself in the hands of God and then this is what happens to you, how does it not test your faith? How does your faith end up surviving?
You're talking about my faith.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. After seeing what your son has been through and what he's done, I just always find it interesting to see what challenges people's faith and what deepens their faith. And I think it's always really unpredictable which is going to happen.
Well, I think, you know, it's entirely possible that he was overwhelmed by giving himself over to Satan. I mean, you know, it's hard. There's so much secularism in our society these days that it's almost taboo to talk about belief in God and so forth, especially in the media. But it's entirely possible, from my standpoint, that he was taken over, that he had given himself up to Satan. And I can't do anything about that. But I have to think that perhaps he would have just gone on his path and harmed more. And if he weren't, it was probably a blessing that he was stopped. So I thank God that he was.
Is Satan a way that can help you understand what happened?
Yes. Mm-hmm. At some point, I mean, I think you have to willingly give yourself over. As long as you maintain a firm belief in God, he'll never test you beyond what you can bear. But if you give a little bit, I think Satan will take over, finally.
So if you believe that maybe Satan had taken your son over, then it's possible to believe that maybe your son will find Jesus at some future point. So you find hope in that.
Mm-hmm. And Terry, he intellectually believes in God and Jesus as his Savior, but he feels so badly, like he is so perverse and so evil that he finds it hard to pray. I just got through praying with him at the prison, and he said, "I guess, Dad, I guess in order to be a Christian, you really have to pray, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah, that's really an integral part of being a Christian or anyone who believes in God." And so, yeah, I have hope.
Lionel Dahmer's memoir is called A Father's Story. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Lionel Dahmer will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, what happens to a father's unconditional love when he discovers his son is a serial killer? We continue our conversation with Lionel Dahmer, father of Jeffrey Dahmer. In Lionel Dahmer's new memoir, he examines his own life and his son's, looking for clues that might explain Jeffrey's gruesome murders. Lionel anguishes over whether his own dark side helped to create his son's. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Associate Attorney General Webster Hubble is resigning. He's been accused of overbilling at his old law firm, the Rose Law Firm of Little Rock, where he worked with First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton. Attorney General Janet Reno made the announcement a short time ago at the Justice Department.
I understand the difficulty of trying to do two things at once, a burden for Webb that no longer seemed tolerable. It is characteristic of Webb that he wanted to give his full attention to one matter or the other, public service or resolving old private disputes. I know nothing of the latter, but of the former I can say unequivocally that Webb Hubble gave fully of himself to make America a better place, and I'm going to miss him.
Hubble has also been involved in the Whitewater controversy. Some of his legal work was on behalf of federal savings and loan regulators, and the Rose firm once represented a failed S&L run by the Clintons' partner in the Whitewater land deal. President Clinton has opened the Group of Seven Jobs Conference in Detroit. He's put a special emphasis on the challenge of creating good jobs in a rapidly changing global economy. NPR's John Itzde reports.
The president welcomed the finance and labor ministers of the G7 nations, saying no one had all the answers, but that through frank discussions, the nations could discover how to create good jobs faster. The president once again called for lower U.S. deficits, lower interest rates in Europe, and economic stimulation in Japan to spur world growth and jobs creation. But he said this conference would go beyond those macroeconomic measures.
For years, the G7 nations consulted with each other about the great issues of macroeconomics and global finance. Today, we are beginning a serious conversation about the economic well-being of ordinary people.
The G7 officials will meet in private sessions this afternoon and tomorrow. The president said he hoped they would agree to an agenda on job creation that could be put before G7 heads of government when they meet this summer in Naples, Italy. I'm John Itzde in Detroit.
The government says business inventories were flat in January after five straight months of gains. The Commerce Department says January sales also dropped 0.3% for the first time in 6 months. An increase can be a warning sign for the economy. If stocks pile up too fast, factories can cut production, and that could mean job layoffs. President Clinton has named Admiral Jeremy Burda as the Navy's top officer. He will replace Admiral Frank Kelso, who resigned last month over the tailhook scandal. Burda is currently the commander of NATO forces in southern Europe. He's now responsible for coordinating and planning NATO military action over Bosnia and in the Mediterranean and Adriatic seas. Stock prices closed up a fraction today on Wall Street. The Dow ended the day at 3,862. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. About 300,000 workers, or rather 3,000 workers, at two General Motors brake plants are off the job today. The United Auto Workers Local 696 called a strike at the Delco Chassis Division plants in Dayton, Ohio. Negotiators have failed to reach agreement on a new contract. Both plants supply brake systems and parts to GM assembly plants around the country. A union spokesman says issues separating the workers and management include job security and contract work. That is work which was first handed to union members but now was sent somewhere else. Talks are scheduled to resume tomorrow morning. Virginia's junior senator has formally kicked off his re-election campaign. From member station WVTF, Jay O'Neill reports.
Democrat Chuck Robb began in southwest Virginia, during which he touted his accomplishments as a former governor of the Commonwealth and a senator for the past 5 years. Rob says he wants a campaign focused on the issues, but the question of his personal character will likely remain a hot topic. Following the release last week of a letter in which he admitted some past personal and political foibles, Rob says there is no reason for further discussion of his private life.
You have my word with God as my witness that everything I have attempted to say at any time, including the letter that I think puts this behind me, is the truth. And if I ever find that I have fallen from that standard, I'd leave public office immediately.
Senator Rob faces political newcomer Sylvia Clute, a Richmond attorney, in the Democratic primary in June. For National Public Radio, Jay O'Neill in Roanoke.
Israeli police are looking for weapons in the homes of Jewish settlers who live in Hebron on the West Bank. They've also detained a prominent rabbi there. Authorities say they're asking him about charges he threatened an Islamic religious official last September and ignored army orders to avoid specific Muslim areas. The questioning comes one day after the Israeli cabinet outlawed two extremist Jewish groups. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jeffrey Dahmer is serving several consecutive life sentences for the murder of 17 males and for necrophilia and cannibalism. His father, Lionel Dahmer, is trying to fathom the unfathomable, how his own son could have committed such hideous crimes. We're going to continue our conversation about Lionel Dahmer's new memoir, A Father's Story, in which he reviews his own life and his son's life, looking for clues to explain why Jeffrey turned out the way he did. In your memoir, A Father's Story, you write that after Jeffrey's crimes were uncovered, we were no longer parents. You were now the father of Jeffrey Dahmer.
Mm-hmm.
Did people expect you to disown him, to distance yourself from him?
Well, some people have said that they, you know, would leave the country or change their name or hide or something, but that actually never occurred to us. Sherry and I, right from the beginning, we just, you know, decided that this is a, well, I'm duty-oriented. My father was very duty-oriented, a provider, a very strong family person, and I got that concept from him. And Sherry is also that way. So we, right from the beginning, we supported him, we visit him, we try to emotionally support him. We've gotten very close. We're a very close triad right now.
Did you try to, I'm just trying to imagine the kind of confusion that you went through about what your relationship to him should be, and should you be the kind of punitive, demanding parent saying, you know, I cannot have a relationship with you unless you change or something?
Oh, no.
Or should you be the
That would never work, Terry.
Right, because, so...
And I wouldn't want it that way. You've got to allow a person their free will. Give them the information. Let them make up their own mind. That's true science.
Unconditional love.
Yeah. And persuade. You know, give your point of view. Look at all the possibilities. But let them make up their own mind. That's the only way it's going to stick.
Okay, and here's something I'm sure a lot of people wonder. I think probably every parent understands unconditional love. Everybody who has a family, understands unconditional
mother.
Love.
Yeah.
But then, like, if somebody does the things that your son did, some people would think, but that's where you draw the line in unconditional love. Can you still love the person when you see what they did, or does it so revile you that you become incapable of maintaining the unconditional
honestly
love?
Honestly speaking, that's very hard. It is. I just find it so hard to relate, even mentally, just intellectually, to what he did. That I know what he did, but I have to almost put that aside with his obsessions and look at, I mean, he really has a good side. He's very polite and considerate. There's an awful lot that's good about him. But this horrible, bad, evil side of him, where this obsession just apparently overwhelmed him, that goes along with the horrible acts. And if I were in the position of being one of the families, you know, of the victims, I would find it hard to even listen to that, I admit. But, that's a horrible mixture of feelings. I'm not very articulate on that because my thinking is so, I feel so much for, I can almost put myself in their position of having my own son, that done to my own son. And not being able to think of that person, Jeff, then as, or I can see how they don't maybe want to think of Jeff as a human being.
How they just want to see him as a monster.
Yeah, just a total depraved, worthless, absolutely low life, nothing.
You say you've gotten closer to your son, but are you able to talk with him about the crimes that he committed? Do you want to be able to talk with him about that?
We don't dwell on that at all. I mean, no, we haven't discussed in detail, you know, the very gruesome details of the. I don't know. To be honest with you, I don't know what purpose that would serve. Maybe I'm missing something. Maybe some purpose would be served by talking about the details. But Sherry and I never talked about the details of his crimes. He had gone over, 60 hours of talking, you know, with detectives, and they came all. Everything was in the transcripts. He just divulged just practically everything to them, and we saw all that.
My guest is Lionel Dahmer. In his new memoir, A Father's Story, he writes about being the father of a serial killer. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lionel Dahmer, and he has a new memoir called A Father's Story that's about being the father of Jeffrey Dahmer. And he asks himself many questions in the book about how Jeffrey turned out the way he did. In your memoir, you keep asking yourself if there were dark impulses in you that you suppressed that somehow your son managed to carry out, whether the dark impulses in you somehow planted the seeds for his behavior. And I wonder how seriously you take that. I mean, everybody's got their dark impulses.
Yeah.
And most of us don't act them out. That's the difference between...
And don't even tell other people.
And don't even tell other people.
This is one thing that came out of writing the book. This is a hypothesis that seemed reasonable to my psychologist and to me. And I think that I really believe this, that, let's compare Jeff and myself. I grew up in a residential area, lots of kids, lots of friends, lots of acquaintances, except when I got to the point of dating, you know, the age of dating. Then I kind of...
Got shy.
Yeah. but there were a lot of kids around. Jeff did not have a lot of kids around. We always lived in an area where there was not a density of kids to play with. I was involved with a lot of activities. My parents were just, they were school teachers. They believed in family. We had relatives. We got together often. My folks, you know, encouraged every kind of activity you can imagine, piano lessons, trumpet, tennis, academia, traveling on vacations. I won't go through all that, but a lot and lots of activities. Now, I did the same with Jeff. I participated with him in 4-H. We raised lambs. I can remember the time the lambs would be jumping down, you know, in the encaged area, and that we built up above our house, and his eyes would sparkle, and he really loved that. We went sled riding, tobogganing. His dog Frisky would be running alongside and trying to grab hold of us in the sled, and Jeff would be laughing. And we went and dug Christmas trees at Christmas time, a tradition, took hot chocolate along. He and I planted all the evergreens in our property. There wasn't one when we moved in. Boy Scouts, trumpet lessons, tennis. He still remembers fondly the time that Arthur Ashe came and gave an exhibition. Just on and on. I don't want to get too far away from the point here, but he had a lot. We had a lot of participative activities. But now here's the diff. This is getting to the final point. I think is crucial here. That I hooked on to things, to some things. I became very, very interested in tennis. I became very interested in going on for a degree, academia. He had all of these various activities, but nothing, and I think I brought that out in the book, where he never latched onto anything. And then the final main point, because he didn't latch onto anything, he didn't latch onto people. I hooked into people because of my activities. Now, if I had not done that, who knows? I'm not saying I would turn out to be a Jeff. I just can't imagine that I would have. But I might be screwed up. It's possible for any kid. In other words, what I'm saying, it's possible for all the parents out there.
I feel like in our culture we tend to often hold parents responsible for the behavior of their children. I'm wondering if you felt you were ever put on trial in some symbolic way for the behavior of your son. If people have been wondering, well, what did the father do? What did the mother do? Is it their fault? Do you feel that you've been judged?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, in the living rooms of parents, yeah, they're saying, yeah, to themselves, perhaps, you know, I wonder, you know, we don't know the whole story. Maybe, you know, I just wonder what we don't know. Was Lionel, you know, did he do anything that we don't know about, or did his mother do anything, or what?
You've been very, you know, hard on yourself, I think, in trying to see what you did that might be responsible. But how do you feel about other people wondering about your responsibility and putting you on trial in some abstract way?
Well, I think probably people that don't know me at all might wonder yet, uh-huh, you know. And so I tried to be forthright with everything that I could think of. And I feel I really would like to, before I die, I would really like some kind of a good, solid scientific study to be done. If Jeff would
cooperate
100%.
I have to say, you strike me so much as the empirical man, the scientist, the chemist, who's used to equations and formulas and things really being explicable, and that you're now dealing with the inexplicable, the mysterious, the emotional, the indescribable, the impossible to come to terms with, and you seem to be struggling so hard with that.
Yeah, it bothers me very much. And I have to think that it bothers a lot of people, too, that a lot of other people, they wonder, just like I do, just at what point. It seems to me that it was around age 14 or 15, that Jeff somehow got his sexuality mixed up with whatever cumulative effect of all the items, the blow to the back of his head with a billy club a bunch of kids gave him near his house one time, a double hernia operation, the many injections, going to the doctor a lot, bones. I don't know. I'm just grasping. But some type of the integration of a whole bunch of individual events coming up to the point of his hormones exerting their tremendous effect and mixing up together with those thoughts and coming out with some bizarre desire, getting excitement or pleasure, whatever, the bunch of adjectives going along with that, insides of animals and so forth, and then later humans. And I can't relate to it, but myself, but I just would really like to know the most. We deal in probabilities. I mean, I deal in probabilities as a scientist too, but I would like to know what the most probable conjecture hypothesis is for this condition. And people have told me the same thing. How could that have happened? Where did he cross the line, whereas I didn't? So I really would like to know.
My guest is Lionel Dahmer. His new memoir, A Father's Story, is about being the father of a serial killer. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing about the reports of Webster Hubbell's resignation. He was Hillary Clinton's law partner in Arkansas and has been working at the Justice Department here in Washington. Also today, a story about bovine growth hormone and the dairy industry, and about unemployment in France. Also, the photo that purported to show the Loch Ness Monster poking its neck up out of the water is now a demonstrable fake, and we'll hear from a British reporter about how that fraud was perpetrated and sustained for 60 years.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Back with Lionel Dahmer. His son is serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer. How has your life changed in the past year since the trial, or in the past few years since the revelation of your son's crimes? I mean, are you back at work? Do you have anything resembling a normal life?
Well, I've tried to keep it separate from work. That is, you know, I work for a very good company. But we try to keep everything separate. No contacts of any kind there. No talk about it there. I just go and do my, you know, my work as
mm-hmm.
usual.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as far as generally speaking, it's been extremely rough for Sherry and I. Not just the mental agony of what has happened, what Jeff has done, but the everyday attacks by other people who want to commercialize on this or attack us, filing suits and so forth.
I just want to ask you a question that's, I'm sure, impossible to answer, but I'll ask it anyways. If you found out about your son's crimes, after he was arrested, you learned about a lot of this in court, right?
Virtually everything.
Say you knew before. Say you or your mother had discovered a body in the basement or something. Do you have any idea what you would have done? Do you think you would have turned your son in or
oh, yeah.
tried to protect him? Or do you have any idea what you would have done?
Do
you ask yourself this?
Yeah, in fact, the thing that prompts me most to think about is that close call. Whenever you've had a close call in your life,
mm-hmm.
you start to really get introspective, and that was that box.
Which box are you talking
about?
The
one that I mentioned in the book where he had this box about a foot square or so. It's like a film box. I suspected that my mother was wondering what was in it. It was always kept locked. And I believe she found it, came across it once in his room. And so I asked him to open it, and he said he didn't want to open it. And I didn't tell him what I thought was in there. I thought there was pornographic material because there had been some pornographic material found before, and which we've, you know, told him to get rid of. I didn't want my mother exposed to that. So he resisted, and I had just given him a birthday check, $25 birthday check, and he put on a little bit of a show. In retrospect, I know that's what it was now, to try to get me off the subject of the box. He tore up the check and said, "If this is what you're, you know, you can't give me one square foot of space, privacy in where I'm living than just forget about it, you know. So he stormed out the door.
So what was in the box?
And I took the box, and I was going to go down to the basement to open it. He came back in, into the house, and he said, "I'm sorry, Dad, I lost my temper. And don't open it tonight. Let's not cause any more fuss," because my mother was right there. "I'll open it tomorrow. I'll show you. It's probably what you think is in it. I'll open it tomorrow morning. Let's just..." So I, in sympathy for his, you know, shyness, the whole feeling of, you know, I was shy, he was shy, and I just didn't want to cause any more embarrassment, I said, "Okay." Because I never dreamed what was in there. There's no way that I could ever imagine what was in there.
What was in there?
It was a human head. And the next morning, he had replaced it with some pornographic materials, and he showed it to me, and I was satisfied. And if I had opened the box and seen that, probably my first thought might be that is it some kind of an artifact or something artificial? And then maybe I would think further and wonder what that was, and I might have totally lost it. I don't know how would I know that I would never cover it up. I'd have to go to the police if I found out, you know. I don't know. I think I would have just... It might have sent me over the edge. I just don't know.
And you ask yourself this a lot.
Yeah. But, you know, no one ever had any vague thought that it might involve some human being. Not only the box, but all the other events, the smells and so forth.
Do you ever expect there'll come a time in your life when you'll stop asking questions about your son and what happened to him and why, and that you'll just... That the kind of torture that you've been experiencing and asking yourself these questions, that torture will stop?
I suppose if there is a study by people that I feel strongly are competent and
that can give you
done
answers
properly, mm-hmm. And if they end up with "I don't know," then I just have to accept that. But it's extremely trying, to say the least.
Lionel Dahmer, thank you very, very much for talking
with
us.
Thank you, Terry.
Lionel Dahmer's new memoir is called A Father's Story. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlees and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
America's schools are slipping backward toward increased isolation by race and class. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Gary Orfield, director of the Harvard Project on School Desegregation. The project found that America's schools are more segregated than they've been in 25 years. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.